Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. One of our listeners, Rachel Ezekiel Fishbein, lost both of her parents in the span of 5 months. They were really sick toward the end, and Rachel spent most of her time in the hospital. She felt isolated.
The outside world didn't exist.
Those long, deserted hallways, the sounds of illness, a daily schedule wrapped up in tests and checks, no fresh air.
And the light was so fake. I felt almost out of body, because I felt like I was removed from the rest of the world, moving at a completely different pace.
When she got to go home for a couple of hours, Rachel felt relief wash over her.
That immediate feeling of fresh air or sunlight on my skin, the loud street sounds, and the energy of the outside world that reminded me that I was alive.
When I think of hospital in a stereotypical way, I think of a big patient ward or a building that is just kind of a nondescript block.
Erin Nunes Cooper is an architect. She specializes in healthcare design at a firm called Ballinger. And she says it doesn't have to be that way.
So a current and modern hospital, when we see that identity really kind of from the exterior, should send a message that it's a welcoming place. And it's a place to kind of heal rather than a place to just be sick.
How do you say that in architect?
How do we say that in architect? A lot of it is said in the design that we come up with, in the materiality that we choose, in the scale and in the texture. And having this idea that a building can be made of materials that are calming or that have a texture that people can relate either to their home or to nature, to something that's a little more familiar than what might be an intimidating machine of a hospital.
So glass, yeah. Light.
We love glass. We love light. We love bringing light in. And it actually helps people just have a connection to the outside as a patient, if you're recovering or if you're healing, you're in a patient room, but also for staff.
Buildings can make us feel safe or scared, cozy or anxious, hot or cold, welcomed or isolated. How we build matters, not just with hospitals. So on today's episode, we're going to take a look at how buildings affect our health and well-being. To start, let's stick with hospitals. They should be built in such a way that they can keep functioning in all kinds of conditions, including extreme weather, to continue to serve patients. But can you build a hospital to withstand even the strongest storms? What does it take? Reporter Jad Slayman looked into that.
Texas Medical Center in Houston is the world's largest medical complex. It has its own skyline. Dozens of buildings, 106,000 employees, caring for some 10 million patients a year. Back in 2001, it was in the path of a tropical storm, Allison. And at first, folks didn't really think that was such a big deal.
We have tropical storms all the time on the Gulf Coast, and it's lots of rain and some minor street flooding, and it goes away.
That's Claire Bassett, Chief Communications Officer at the Baylor College of Medicine. Baylor is basically the nucleus of the medical center.
It was just, oh, it's another tropical storm. It's going to be a wet weekend. It'll be over and done with.
But day after day, Allison's heavy rains simply did not stop. And Texas Medical Center was in trouble. High waters got into a tunnel system, flooded multiple buildings. Patients were evacuated and hospitals closed down. Claire made her way to the medical school the day after the rains finally subsided.
So our entire sub-basement was submerged.
That's the floor below the basement.
And then 5 feet of the floor above that. And we had the vast majority of our animal research was in our sub-basement.
In what's called a vivarium, basically cages, animals with their food and bedding and scientific equipment.
We actually had a cow We had rabbits, we had canines, and all of the large animals were able to be led up to a higher floor by one of our animal care attendants who had waded through chest-deep water to get here.
He somehow led the cow up two flights of stairs.
And this gentleman who I had never met before walked up to me and said, "I just put a cow in the ladies' room." I said, "Okay, that's great. Did you put a sign on the door?"
He had not. Slipped his mind somehow.
So we put signage on the door, and he said, "Is it okay if I put dogs and pigs in a vacant conference room in a vacant office?"
So cows, dogs, pigs, all in the clear. The research mice were not so lucky. Claire sent me pictures of the room just after Cruz got in. You see stacks of these plastic cages, four high, all filled with foggy water. And some, you see blurry little white things floating.
So we lost about 30,000 research mice.
30,000. Many of them bred over several generations as part of genetic studies. They also lost a bank of breast cancer tissues with 25 years worth of samples.
And our losses exceeded $300 million.
Years of medical science washed away. But things could have been much worse. The nightmare scenario, losing patients during a crisis, was avoided. But that wasn't the case in New Orleans after Katrina. Management and urban planning researchers Lucy Arndt and David Hess traveled there in 2005, just after the storm.
I mean, just catastrophic damage. I mean, it was quite, we wore masks as we walked about the neighborhoods.
The city was still closed off when they arrived.
And it was bizarre in that it was bright and sunny the whole time that we were there on top of, so bright and sunny and all of this death basically around us. Decay, high water marks, vehicles that had been abandoned, vehicles in trees.
Their mission was to go hospital to hospital to see what went wrong and what went right.
So hospitals in general are incredibly complex organizations, far more so than most other types of organizations, in that hospitals typically, at least acute care hospitals, tend to be just like communities.
During extreme weather, these complex little communities have two choices, neither very good. There's shelter in place, essentially ride out the storm, or evacuate, which David says is even more dangerous.
Worst case scenario for hospital administrators is to think about a complete evacuation and having to move everybody.
But New Orleans hospitals simply weren't built for Katrina's wrath. They buckled.
At Memorial, at Lindy Bar, I mean, one after the other, it was the same story over and over. It was just this thing out of some horror movie.
If Memorial sounds familiar, it's because dozens of patients died there. Healthcare workers were accused of euthanizing some amid desperate conditions.
The hospitals became very unsafe places to be. In fact, one hospital administrator's recollection of the hospital following Hurricane Katrina is that it was like a war zone inside.
Both researchers say New Orleans was especially vulnerable, but that doesn't mean hospitals elsewhere are safe. With climate change driving more frequent and more intense storms, experts say more hospital systems have to be better able to essentially batten down the hatches.
You know, hospitals from outside of the Gulf area learning the lessons of Katrina, well, in the past, they might not have thought, oh yeah, that might relate to us, but it is becoming pretty self-evident, I think, that in fact those lessons are increasingly relevant to more hospitals.
Superstorm Sandy, for instance, shut down New York City's Bellevue Hospital in 2012 after basement fuel pumps flooded. The National Guard stepped in to help staff run fuel and water before finally evacuating everyone. Lucy says hospitals typically reach their breaking points when they lose either power or water, and the engineering that could help ensure that doesn't happen is incredibly expensive, especially in the context of a hospital.
And when you start talking about changing a building, a hospital structure, for example, we start talking millions of dollars. And in a climate where healthcare costs are already considered pretty extraordinary, starting to talk to people about the need to modify a building so that we can be better prepared for something that may never happen, that can be a pretty tough sell.
But Back in Houston, after Allison, preparedness wasn't such a tough sell anymore.
If you look over there and see that line right over there? This was filled with 33 feet of water when Tropical Storm Allison occurred. So you can actually see the line right there, the tide line. I had them specifically do not pressure wash that line off. See it over there?
That's Robert Emery, aka Safety Bob. He's a professor of occupational health in charge of risk management at the University of Texas Health Science Center. It's part of the Texas Medical Center, and he's pointing to residue left on a building by floodwaters 18 years ago. When he talks about Allison, he repeats a curious phrase.
So, we got religion.
He means the storm taught everyone a lesson to respect a kind of higher power.
Where we are sitting right now, literally, you could look that way and that way. This is 185,000 square feet, and you could see all the way through because all of this was cut out. All the walls, all the doors, everything, because it was all underwater.
He's in the basement of the McGovern Medical School, again, part of the Texas Medical Center. It was once the largest state-owned building in Texas.
Ceiling collapsed, all that stuff, right? So, I mean, it was huge. It was actually a sobering experience to get down on your hands and knees, and you could look from one end of this building to the other.
They weren't going to get caught off guard again. Bob outlines the engineering built up in the years after Allison. First, a moat.
If you were looking out from overhead with a drone, you would see that there's actually, again, almost like a reverse moat around the entire building.
He's talking about a hydrostatic wall, about 7 feet tall, a mix of granite and a half inch of glass.
This glass is actually glass like an aquarium. And so if you can hear how thick it is, it's like SeaWorld.
And outside of that, an earthen berm. There's pumps in this reverse moat to get rid of any water that makes it over. But then, even if all that fails...
I guess the best way to describe it is think of a bank vault door, and there's four of them, and they're 16 feet high.
There's nearly two dozen of these flood doors just around McGovern in various sizes.
But one person, they're actually balanced in such a way that one person can actually move them and swing them and then put them into place.
Some pins lock into place. A pump inflates rubber seals. Safety Bob is constantly drilling his staff on how to do this, and not long ago, they were put to the test.
Torrential rain, people rescued from flooded homes, volunteers with...
Hurricane Harvey. It beat out Allison for total rainfall, devastated the region. But at the Texas Medical Center buildings...
So maybe 6 inches of water in this loading dock area compared to 33 feet of water in the past.
33 feet with Allison, 6 inches with Harvey. The engineering worked. In fact, the only major problem was getting staff to and from these relatively dry little islands amid a flooded Houston. Bob's team is working on a solution to that, too.
So we now have those two. I forgot the military name for them, but it's like a deuce and a half or something like that. But it's these two huge military trucks.
They're military surplus M35 2.5-ton cargo trucks, about 9 feet tall, so good in high water. The staff named them.
Laverne and Shirley.
And the research animals, like generators and critical mechanicals, they're now kept safely on upper floors. Claire, the communications officer who described returning to the chaos at Baylor following Allison, set up shop at the TMC before Harvey hit.
You bring a nice air mattress and you bring... water boots, and you bring a couple of changes of clothes.
She didn't see some Texas Noah leading animals out of a flood. Instead, she walked the mostly dry halls checking for broken glass. Harvey shut down other outpatient facilities outside the medical center. Claire remembers cancer patients worrying about how they'd get their regular treatments. But as soon as the roads were clear enough for them to get to the Texas Medical Center, they found it was ready for them.
Yet we were able to get our infusion patients in, and when we went and saw them, I guess 3 days after the storm is when we opened it, there were people literally in tears. They were so thankful.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. Elizabeth Troval of Houston Public Media contributed to the story. Philadelphia is mostly a city of row homes built from brick. Many of them are over 100 years old. But now when you look at new construction going up, what you see is wood frames, Tyvek wrap, and metal siding. And some people, myself included, are giving these new homes the side eye. Are they as good as brick? Are these materials sturdy enough to stick around? Have they been studied and tested? Reporters Steph Yin from The Pulse and Jake Blumgard, he's a housing reporter, looked into this matter. And Steph, where did you start out?
So we started off at a construction site right in our neighborhood where both Jake and I live in South Philadelphia. We visited a site of a multifamily home that's going up. So there were builders up on scaffolding. And they're building this home that is two times the size of a normal row house. So the biggest house on the block. It has these gray metal panels. So it's looking very metal compared to the red brick homes around it.
The interior is all wood, and you could kind of see the skeleton.
And Jake, you talk to a lot of people about houses and housing. What do folks say about structures like this that are so, they look so different from everything else?
So a lot of the older residents I talk with in my, you know, general reporting worry that they're not going to last, that they're going to burn down or they're going to rot away.
I hear a lot of times people call these homes like flimsy or cheap. So the two of you try to find out whether that is really true. Is it just that the aesthetics hit us the wrong way, or will these homes really crumble? So who did you talk to and what did you find out, Jake?
So the first guy I spoke with is John Carr, and he's a materials conservationist, which basically means that he repurposes and fixes up old things for use in the modern world. John is team brick all the way.
I certainly would be buying a house that was built in the 1880s if I was trying to protect my investment and my asset. There are masonry buildings in Philadelphia from 1690 that are being maintained, that are in incredible condition.
Yeah, so John works out of a former firehouse in Philadelphia, and it's built like a fortress. The walls are 2 feet thick, and it's just this really amazing, imposing tower.
So how come we don't really build like this anymore? Where did bricks go? Where did stone go?
Things really started to change after World War II. When people were moving to the suburbs, the suburban building boom really favored super fast construction, wood frames, ready to assemble homes.
5 years ago, this was a vast checkerboard of potato farms on New York's Long Island. Today, a community of 60,000 persons living in 15,000 homes, all built by one firm.
That meant brick masons and manufacturers became harder to come by. I talked to a developer who works in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Anthony Delgat. He mostly builds wood frame homes. He says, for one, brick has become too expensive.
Masonry construction is just not cost effective right now. It's cheaper to build in steel than it would be to get masons out there.
Brick is also not the best choice when it comes to the environment. The manufacture and transport of masonry materials is a major contributor to climate change. Bricks have to be burned, and that means using fossil fuels. Wood is abundant and accessible. It can be replenished with relative ease. And because it doesn't weigh as much as brick and stone, it burns less gas to transport.
And Steph, you looked more into the material science aspect of all of this, how durable these materials are that we're using to build homes. What did you find out?
Right. So thinking about environmental concerns, when you think about how green something is, you have to take into account its full life cycle. So its origins to how long it lasts, its durability. So thinking about these new materials, sheet metal, composite wood, vinyl, stucco, how do these things hold up? A lot of it depends on design and craftsmanship. I talked to John Fernandez, an architect who teaches at MIT.
You can't disentangle the design from the material selection. So in other words, you can have a really inexpensive material, but put in a place in the building and designed in a way that will function really well and will be very durable. You can also have a really, really high quality material, you know, really good brick or stone, and you could put it in a building in a way that it's not going to be very durable.
There are, of course, some inherent differences between materials. I talked to a material scientist, Nishant Garg, about some pros and cons between wood, metal, and brick. When it comes to strength,
your metals will be strongest. Ceramics, like bricks, would be number two. And then wood will be number three.
The more porous a material is, the less strong it is.
So wood happens to have the highest porosity among all other materials. And metals have the lowest amount of porosity. So metals like steel can withstand much, much higher stresses, and they're much more dense.
In terms of protection against heat and cold, all those pores in wood are actually helpful. They act like lots of little air pockets that provide insulation. And metal is the worst insulator. It's actually a heat conductor. Then, when it comes to moisture, of course, wood shouldn't have any direct contact with water. If it's used on an exterior, it needs to be treated with a protective layer. Otherwise, you'll have mold, warping, shrinkage.
And what happens is when the builders don't think about the properties of the materials they're using, that can lead to disaster, as many homeowners learned recently when they found structural rot and mold hidden in the walls of their relatively new homes.
Forcing some families out of their new homes.
Mold growing inside the walls and around AC units. Some homeowners are fed up with it.
So different materials have different strengths and weaknesses. But nowadays, with advances in materials science, you can also engineer materials to look like one thing and behave like another. These are composite or hybrid materials.
The old school thinking is you just have three kind of materials, right? Ceramics, metals, and polymers. But with these composite materials, you are really breaking down the boundaries and the walls between these systems. You know, you're actually looking at anything around you. It's likely to be a composite.
Think IKEA furniture that looks like wood, but is strong like steel and lightweight like vinyl. Those are the kinds of materials people are using to build houses. So there's so much more now than meets the eye.
You cannot really trust what you see. Now it is so sophisticated that it's very easy to kind of fool people.
Nishant says just looking at a structure won't tell you much. If you want a real look behind the facade, you have to ask specific questions about what kinds of materials were used and how.
But architect Jeremy Avellino told me, don't panic just because you see wood framing.
It's not that like heavy masonry is better than wood framing, and a lot of those old wood frame buildings with care and maintenance are doing just fine.
So you can't make a snap judgment or have moral associations with material.
I have hope that we will transcend this tired nostalgia about a past that was really complicated.
Jake Blumgard and Steph Yin reported this piece. So, Steph, if you were to buy a house right now, would it be brick or some of these new materials?
Well, I still hate the look of these houses that are going up everywhere. I think, you know, in these city neighborhoods, they just look so different and disruptive.
How about you, Jake? Brick or new stuff?
I'm afraid I'm also a partisan of brick. I really love the look of the old neighborhoods in Philadelphia, and the two-story row houses, even though they're very small, also look very cozy and well-built, and I want one.
But it sounds like it's really about looks and not the strength of material per se.
Right. It's all about the aesthetics.
We're talking about buildings. How we build impacts the future of our cities, but also our health and well-being. Buildings shelter us from the elements. They provide a place to cool down in the summer and warmth in the winter. In New York City, more than 80% of residential buildings are heated by steam. These heating systems have their roots in the past, and now they face an uncertain future. Emily Pontecorvo reports.
A cold winter night in a typical New York City apartment building has a soundtrack.
It would usually kind of like begin with this sort of like distant like hiss, like something felt like it was like kind of creeping through the walls. And sometimes it was just like extremely loud. Like I would wake up from these pipes like clanging, and it was like a storm of just like bom, bom, bom.
It was like an infernal whistling.
It just sounds like there's something alive in the pipes that is trying to break free.
There's the noise, and then also, people with steam heating usually don't have any control over the temperature in their apartments.
It's hot. It's on
constantly.
It's boiling hot.
In the middle of winter, it was snow covering my window, and I would always have to open the window up.
Steam heat means a boiler in the basement that burns some kind of fuel to heat water into steam. The steam shoots up through the building via pipes that send it into radiators to heat people's apartments. And so many New Yorkers have to open their windows in the winter because it's too hot. About three quarters of the buildings in New York City were built over just a few decades, from the 1900s to the 1930s. During that time, steam heat reigned supreme. I spoke to Dan Holohan, who wrote a book called The Lost Art of Steam Heating. To Dan, the history of home heating is this gripping story of survival.
You know, people would die from the cold. I mean, winter was almost like a character in a novel. You know, it was personified in my mind. It would come indoors and try to steal your kids.
When Dan started researching steam heat about 50 years ago, he started digging around in old engineering textbooks and boiler manuals and trade magazines. And in one of the textbooks, he stumbled upon something that explains so much about why steam heating systems have all these problems today. It was this bizarre specification.
We have to size the boiler for the coldest day of the year with the wind blowing and the windows open. And I said, what the heck is that all about?
That's right. At one time, it was actually standard to install boilers that were big enough for people to open their windows in the dead of winter and still be warm. And when Dan dug a little deeper, he started to figure out why.
Looking at people just living in horrible conditions, and so many of the diseases that we were having were airborne, and they were caused by unhealthy water and unhealthy air.
Lots of people were dying from tuberculosis and outbreaks like the Spanish flu. But medical science was advancing. Germ theory started to enter the public consciousness, and fresh air came to be seen as one of the best measures to prevent the spread of disease. In 1901, fresh air was literally written into the building code. The New York State Tenement House Act mandated that every room have a window facing the outside. And along with that came the doctor's orders: keep your bedroom windows open. Dan concluded that this fixation on the curative power of fresh air influenced the heating systems that were installed when most of New York City was being built.
The pipes and the radiators are probably the exact same pipes and radiators that were installed originally in 1912. They're very robust systems.
The boilers had to push out enough heat so that you could open your windows in the winter. And these big, old systems are still there. This is Sean Brennan, the Associate Director of Research at Urban Green Council. Sean's done a lot of work on steam heat in New York City, and he says there's another historical factor that totally screwed up these systems. Throughout the 20th century, the fuel source kept changing.
So originally they were using coal, and it was a very different process. Someone had to man this coal boiler and probably stoke it. And so the system was designed in a certain way with a certain size.
But then oil became the fuel source of choice. Here's Dan again.
No, you know, nobody expected that we're going to take coal and then start burning oil when they made the boiler. So we're going to put in an oil burner. How big should it be? How do I know? So what the oil people did was they came up with rules of thumb, and they generously oversized it because they didn't want to get hurt by guessing too small.
And then the next iteration, of course, is natural gas, and that creates all kinds of other problems. And again, we didn't really downsize. We just put in the same size or even gave ourselves an extra safety factor to make sure that no one was too cold.
So everybody put something extra in there. And now when the boiler fails, a contractor comes along and he looks at the boiler and he puts back exactly what's in there.
Today, these oversized systems are energy hogs. They burn tons of fossil fuel just to let the heat out through the windows. And now they're coming under increased scrutiny. Earlier this year, New York City passed a landmark law to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the law specifically targets buildings. Here's Mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, talking about it at a press conference.
Now, why are we so focused on the buildings? Because turns out, my friends, they're the number one cause of greenhouse gas emissions. It's not the cars, it's the buildings.
It is possible to make steam heat systems run more efficiently. Urban Green Council, where Sean works, looked into this, and they made a list of improvements that can reduce a building's fuel use by about 20%, and often more. One obvious solution: install a smaller boiler. And Sean says these fixes aren't all that expensive.
We found that actually it's going to be less than $1 per square foot for your typical multifamily building to fix it.
Sean said a typical multifamily building is about 75,000 square feet. To make all the suggested changes would cost somewhere between $75,000 and $100,000. Here's the thing. For a long time, there's been no serious incentive to do this. Natural gas is cheap. People don't really feel the full cost of inefficient heating on their wallets. But soon, because of de Blasio's new law, these inefficient buildings could be hit with a penalty.
So we will have to get rid of this form of heating eventually. Our guess is that somewhere between, you know, 2030 and 2050 is when that big wave of steam replacements is going to be happening.
The new law aims to reduce citywide emissions by 40% by 2030. And improving steam heat is crucial to hitting that. But the city's long-term plan is to get to zero emissions by 2050. And there's no real way to heat an apartment with steam without burning some fossil fuels. It's not going to be easy. Just imagine thousands of buildings and ripping out pipes and radiators. People might have to move out of entire floors of buildings. Will all these headstrong New Yorkers really put up with that? Sean is optimistic. He says there's momentum around making these changes and that if we want to avoid the worst effects of climate change, we can't ignore steam heat anymore.
For big cities like New York, you can address your buildings. They are things that are stationary, people are used to investing in, and we know they're going to be here. So let's make the investment now.
That's Sean's hope, but not all New Yorkers are on board yet. Kate Flanagan grew up in a New York City apartment building that was built in 1901. Her family still lives there, and she asked her dad if there was any talk about changing the heating system.
And my dad, you know, he has lived in New York his whole life, and he wrote back a very short response that said, steam now and steam forever.
That story was reported by Emily Pontecorvo. Thanks to the Tenement Museum in New York City for helping out with this story. We're talking about buildings today on The Pulse. How we build matters. The design of structures impacts how we feel when we're inside. When it comes to public housing, many cities have replaced high-rises with smaller buildings, like row homes or multiple family units. Public housing high-rises have become associated with terrible living conditions, with decay, vandalism, and crime. How did they get that reputation? Daryl C. Murphy has more.
The two towers at Fairhill Apartments in North Philadelphia stand at 18 stories. Together, they take up about half the length of the block. The 56-year-old structures look like a concrete grid with squares of brick and black metal, a little bit like a giant Jenga tower. People hang out outside the buildings, chatting, some going back and forth between the towers. There are only 13 high-rises left that are owned by the Philadelphia Housing Authority, providing homes to some of the city's low-income residents.
But this is all right. I had to get used to this little space because I come from a bigger unit.
Shirley Reynolds has lived in Fairhill for about a year. She likes her apartment, but it's likely she'll have to go somewhere else. And she is just delighted.
I'm happy.
Fairhill is in bad shape. Everything from the heat and hot water systems to the bathroom and kitchen fixtures are in need of repair or replacement. Shirley and her neighbors complain about filthy elevators, grimy hallways, smelly stairwells, and squatters who mosey past security. And then there's the vermin.
It's a lot of mice because you hear them in the walls. I'm just praying they don't never come in my house.
The Housing Authority estimated needed repairs would cost up to $81 million over 20 years. So they gave the tenants a choice. Keep operating the buildings as is, or demolish them and start over. And residents
voted for them to tear it down, redo it. It needs to be done.
A couple miles southwest, the agency demolished a pair of high-rises to replace the units with low-rise housing. Housing Authority President Kelvin Jeremiah says another set of high-rises in West Philadelphia may be next. What gives?
We find here in Philly that our families don't do too well in high-rises.
In 1968, the federal government restricted the use of high-rises for public housing for families with children. More than 20 years later, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, created a program called Hope 6. It offered local housing authorities grants to redevelop their old housing stock. This led to a demolition spree of towers nationwide. Dozens of high-rises in Philadelphia alone were demolished through the program. But could the high-rises have worked? Was there another way?
I wouldn't get too caught up on just the notion of high-rise, you know, being bad. It's the spatial concentration of all low-income people into one setting, which is bad.
Kevin Gillen is a senior research fellow with Drexel University's Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation, and he's worked in housing for decades.
I worked at HUD in the mid to late 90s when the HOPE 6 program was being implemented by the Clinton administration.
Kevin says on paper, high-rises seemed an efficient way to house lots of people.
It's much easier to manage 100 units that are in one building than 100 units that are scattered all over your city, right? It's just easier if they're all spatially concentrated in one place.
But that concentration led to different costs.
Higher rates of crime, higher incidences of fire and vandalism, lower school quality, things like that.
Kevin says in that setting, residents see few examples of social mobility. Programs like Hope 6 aim to change this with spread out, mixed income, low rise housing. Kevin found this had positive effects on the neighborhoods where towers once stood.
We examined what happened to housing values in those neighborhoods where the public high-rises were demolished and then redeveloped into low to mid-rise mixed-income units. And there was a significant positive spillover effect on the housing stock in those communities. We found that house prices per square foot approximately doubled.
The pushback against high-rises was also fueled by something called the defensible space theory. It was introduced in the 1970s by the late architect Oscar Neumann. His argument was that many high-rises weren't designed to make tenants feel a sense of responsibility for their community. One argument was that the more a space seems public, the less tenants feel responsible for it.
Take a look at the space provided for the automobile under the buildings. We find that the people don't use them. It's simply, if you park your car here, it'll be vandalized at night.
Basically, if 100 people have to take care of one property, it's less likely to be cared for. But give one person one property, upkeep is more likely. At Fairhill Towers in Philadelphia, longtime tenant Valerie Russ knows a little bit about this.
I come out here and clean the hallway, but I'm not the only able-bodied person that live on this floor, not to mention squatters.
It'll be a while before redevelopment begins at Fairhill. But when it does, residents will be relocated until new structures are built. Valerie says she is looking forward to the change.
All this nice stuff they built on the ground, that's what I want. I think I've been here long enough and put up with other people's dirt to deserve my own little nice house.
That story was reported by Daryl C. Murphy. Coming up, turning a house into a home and losing your sanity along the way.
During this time, my dentist recommended I wear a mouthpiece while sleeping. I had started to grind my jaw at night to the point where my teeth started cracking.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about how we build and how buildings impact our lives, our health, and well-being. When architects design a building, they have to think about who will use it and how. How will people and things move around? And they have to consider different abilities and special needs.
I went to a restaurant that was listed as wheelchair accessible. I got there and there was a step to get in the restaurant.
This is my friend, psychologist Dan Gottlieb. He has been using a motorized wheelchair for most of his life.
So their standards are wheelchair accessible means that they can pick up a wheelchair and carry it over the step. Well, they're thinking manual chairs, first of all. You know, my chair plus me is close to 500 pounds. And not only that, my God, in case of fire, they're not going to be racing over to me to get me out. So, no, that wasn't accessible.
Since the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, was passed in 1990, there are specific rules and regulations that are supposed to be met. But just because a place says accessible, it doesn't mean it actually works for people.
So, I mean, I've had many, many experiences like this. Technically, it's ADA compliant, but it shows that that's all they want, is to be ADA compliant.
Architect Brenda Zhang says this kind of thing happens all the time, where accessibility is more of an afterthought, something you do to pass inspection.
A lot of places, you'll notice like a lift that's been installed after the fact that's for a wheelchair user, or you'll notice a sign with Braille somewhere that is kind of like in a ridiculous spot, like how would someone know to read it there, right? Buildings with like 10 bathrooms, but only one of them is accessible to a wheelchair user. You know, the list goes on.
Dan told me, on the other hand, when a building is actually designed with people like him in mind, it's a totally different experience.
I feel welcomed into the building. I feel cared for. Now, that's a gift for me, because my hunch is, Mike, and you don't feel that when you walk into a building. It's a building. But boy, if it's accessible, not just accessible, but accommodating, yeah, I feel cared for, I feel safe, and I can relax a little bit.
That's the kind of feeling architect Brenda Zhang wants people to have. And to make that happen, accessibility has to be part of the design from the start, even in small details.
When we're talking about folks with autism, for instance, or other kinds of like sensory disability, something as simple as providing task lighting instead of overhead lighting allows an individual to have a lot more control over their space. So in a lab environment, it might be a series of lights that are directly over the lab table, the working table. In an office setting, it might be a small desk lamp on each person's desk. Fluorescent lighting also has like a low acoustic that is also very distracting for folks who might have a sensitivity to that.
The hum, the kind of buzz.
Absolutely, yeah.
Brenda says good design comes from understanding people's experiences, having them share their concerns and difficulties in different spaces.
Having sloped walking surfaces versus steps, you know, we're thinking automatically about folks who are using wheelchairs. But for users of the building who are deaf, it also helps them, even if they're not using a wheelchair in addition, because they're signing to each other and they're looking at each other's hands while they're walking, and steps kind of get in the way of that. So starting to like connect how some of these things affect disabled communities, centering all of these communities actually provides for a better built environment for everyone.
Brenda Zhang is co-founder of Space Industries, an architectural design collective based out of the Bay Area. You're listening to The Pulse. We've been talking about buildings, how they make us feel and how they impact our health and well-being. Houses can be headaches, major ones. Reporter Peter Crimmins found that out when he bought a fixer-upper that required a lot more fixing than he had bargained for.
When my wife and I looked at a house a few years ago with a real estate agent, we noticed the hideous floor-to-ceiling mirrored wall in the living room, an oddly tiny bathroom, and the kitchen floor had a troubling slope. And I was thinking, we can tinker with this, knock down a wall here, shore up the floor there, demolish and expand the bathroom. But my wife got scared that the house was going to require endless weekends of renovation. She took the real estate agent aside and asked if he had something more modern, something that wouldn't steal away her husband. And the agent said we were never going to find a better deal for a house on a block that was this good. So we did it. We bought it. The first thing I did was tear up the kitchen flooring, and there was a lot of it. Over the years, previous owners had decided to keep putting down new linoleum without taking off the old. So there were six layers of flooring down there. And when I got to the bottom, I discovered a much worse problem. The kitchen did not have a foundation, just stacks of loose brick in the dirt. Okay, so we decided the whole back end of the house had to be demolished, a concrete foundation poured, and then a new kitchen built on top. So it's pretty major. Contractors were hired. There was concrete guys, carpenters, plumbers, electrical, tile, drywall, the whole thing. In an attempt to control the rebuild and maybe save a little money, I decided not to hire a single project manager, but wrangle all the contractors myself. Dumb idea. Juggling contractors is a full-time job, not one to take on while holding down your own 9-to-5. I always felt irritable, always waiting for the next disaster. About midway through the project, my wife and I decided to take a few days away to go to the Jersey Shore, a much-needed vacation. But instead, I was in our motel room at the beach, wrangling contractors and putting out fires. My wife didn't have much of a husband on that vacation, and I came back just as stressed out as I had left. In between the contractors, I decided that since the house is just an empty husk at this point, it would be prudent to tear out all the old plaster. It was a century old, it's crumbling, and I would replace it all with new drywall. Removing plaster is a terrible, demoralizing job. What you do is punch a hole in the wall with a hammer and then slide a pry bar into that hole and wrench the plaster off of its wooden slats. It falls off in great boulders of plaster and a thick cloud of dust. You do that over and over and over. The ceiling, too, until there is a rubble about a foot deep on the floor. And then you shovel, literally, tons of broken plaster into trash bags and haul them out into a U-Haul box truck outside. The work is choking. It's backbreaking. However much plaster you carry out, there's always that much more plaster yet to be bagged. The stress of it wore at me. I couldn't sleep at night. I wasn't eating that much either. People at work started asking if I was okay. This was the summer. It was hot. And I would take a break from shoveling plaster to go to the corner deli for a sandwich and a soda. I was really skinny at that point. I was dirty from the plaster, and I always had a broken look in my eyes. The lady working behind the counter followed me around the store, worried that I was going to steal something. That summer, I saw my dermatologist for my annual checkup. As I took my clothes off for the doctor so he could inspect my skin, he gasped because I had tiny cuts all over my body from wrestling tons of broken plaster out of that house, along with old lumber spiked with rusty nails. And during this time, my dentist recommended I wear a mouthpiece while sleeping. I had started to grind my jaw at night to the point where my teeth started cracking. In tearing the house apart, I noticed some weird things that the previous owner had done. Inside one of the walls was a door. It used to be a doorway to the side alley, but at some point it was sealed over. And rather than remove the door, they just sealed it inside the wall. Now I'm building the house back, and I'm making my own strange decisions. I had to replace some bricks in the chimney inside, and I thought, let's have some fun with this. I ordered some handmade glazed clay tile depicting a bunny and a bear. They're now embedded in the brick side by side. If we ever sell this house, the next owner is going to wonder why there is a bunny and a bear inlaid in the chimney. It's a private joke between my wife and I. I don't think I could explain it. I'm not sure if I fully understand it myself. But it's our joke, just like this is our house, and we're going to burn ourselves into it, for better or worse.
That's reporter Peter Crimmins telling us about his home and all of the renovations he's put into it. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tong, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. For this episode, we partnered with WHYY's Plan Philly. Be sure to check out their work online at planphilly.com. This week, we say goodbye to our intern, Andreas Copes. Thank you so much for all of your hard work. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Our house, in the middle of our house, it has a crowd. There's always something.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund, PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.